One of the main difficulties in this subject is to be able to maintain the author that you study at the beginning fresh enough as you add layers of authors on top. I mean, Well, in the case of slaves, and I'm going to quickly talk about what you were saying. In the case of slaves, not only was slavery a way of enforcing people to work for free for you, the key concept that you have to understand is that the cruelty of slavery is multi-layered, and it's geared to destroy the person at the core of its soul. These people, slaves, were dehumanized. One of the ways of imposing slavery was to deny the fact that they were equal to men, that they were actually not as intelligent, not as worthy. They were not creatures of God. They were something else. And by dehumanizing the slaves, it was easier to enforce someone that you would consider in the same degree that you would consider a farm animal than to consider this person a human being with feelings and with rights and with the same amount of suffering and joy than you would have. So there were many stigmas and many false ideas that were floated around the ideas of slaves, like that they didn't feel pain, or they had a very high tolerance to pain. Why was that an idea that would be successful? Because that would justify inflicting physical harm to slaves, because it didn't hurt them that much. Even if it looked very ugly, they could manage a whipping without complaining as much as other people, because their tolerance to pain was very high. Their intelligence was subpar with white people. Those ideas were floated as normal ideas, and that was a way of justifying any process of dehumanization is a process of justifying slavery. Everyone that's a human being. But if you remove the layer of humanity from a black person, then according to this white privilege principle, you can justify slavery in a way that would not be tolerable in any other part of the world. And in fact, it was forbidden in most parts of the world. The funny thing is that while the English had slaves in America, they didn't have slaves in England. Everyone that was in English territory was considered a free man. The same thing that Spanish people did also with black slaves. The Dutch did the same. The French did the same. So it's not only an English practice. And even though the most horrible consequences were the entire century of slavery that was in the face of the world happening in America, that was supposed to be the land of the free. At the same time, it was something that all of the superpowers had authorized and that had accepted, and that he even had made money off of the the business. So there were slaving companies in London, in Brussels, or in Cadiz, and that's a reality. And as horrible as it is, maybe the most visible slave trade was the one that took place in America, but it was by no means something of only one country. It was an extended thing. It was like a Western privilege, a privilege of the white people. There were a certain standards for white people, and there was a certain standards for any other race, the African race being the most exploited of all of them. Okay? So, first of all, how the hell do we pronounce his name? Olaude Equiano. Okay, so that would be the correct way of saying it. I always mispronounce his first name. I'm terribly sorry about that. But it's really complicated for me to remember the name. But I looked it up so because I wanted to try to be precise. I haven't been able to learn it so far. I pronounce it much better than I used to a couple of years ago, but so I'm making progress. What we see here, I want you to understand that there are two key factors, and it's going to be very important. So if you're going to write something down today, write this down. Because it took me a while to understand how important these things were when I was a student, and I think it opens up your mind to understanding. There are two things that start to break the chains of slavery, and they have nothing to do with physical power. Their literacy is the first one, and religion. If I embrace, first of all, if I'm able to explain my story, I'm going to be able to set an example, just to shame all the people that have mistreated me, to denounce everything that's going on, to increase the pressure on the slavery movement, to reinforce the abolitionist movement. So literacy for slaveries, not to be analfabeto, not to be illiterate, is a key factor for slaves to seek their freedom. That's why it was considered incredibly dangerous for a slave to learn how to read and to write. So this is why Olaude Equiano's work is so harmful for the Southern society or for the American society. That's why Phyllis Wheatley's work is even more dangerous, because not only could she write, she was a genius. And she was as good as any other poet that was writing at the time. So that leads to destroy one of those ideas that were floating around. Their intelligence is inferior. That therefore, we can treat them a bit like animals because they really don't understand. They really don't suffer at the same level as we do. Phyllis Wheatley was so intelligent that most of the people that read her poems did not believe that she was able to write that type of poems. And she had to certify in front of a panel of experts that she was able to produce that type of work. It reached that level of unhumanity. We're going to read in total two units that are very, very strongly related to slavery in the first semester. We're going to read two more in the second semester, and one third one that is taking slavery to a fictionalized point. Mark Twain, Harriet Beecher Stowe, Frederick Douglass in the second semester. Now we're going to focus on Olaude Equiano and on Phyllis Wheatley. We study them together. Why? Because it makes sense, because it's going to help us understand slavery as a whole. The life of the slavery in the worst conditions, these conditions, and this can be considered an extreme Bildungsroman. If you don't remember what a Bildungsroman is, I always get those faces, the one I just saw Marisa put. A Bildungsroman is a story of a coming of age of a person, passing from youth to adulthood. It's normally a story that has to do with success, self-achievement, overcoming challenge. It covers the principles of storytelling, of finding a hero, the hero having to face a challenge, and the hero overcoming the challenge and being able to create closure in the story. From the point of view of of slaves. Those buildings Romans were written in the first person, and they were normally very brutal. And the brutality that they had in the way they described their kidnapping in Africa, how they arrived to the New World, how they were moved around as if they were furniture, and how they had reached freedom, that was not only inspirational, but it was a tremendous denouncement of the situation that they were undergoing. So I would say that it's by no means far-fetched to call these extreme buildings Romans. Why is religion important? Religion is important for slaves, because once they prove, or once they have, they convince one single person that they're also sons of God, it makes absolutely no sense to support any of the tenets of slavery. Because in the eyes of God, the ultimate purpose is to lead to salvation those that are worthy of salvation. And by embracing the religion of their captors, they are accepting that even though their captors are horrible, their religion isn't. And therefore, it becomes more difficult for the enslavers to justify these ideas of slavery, the necessity of enslaving a person that just wants to love God and be loved by God. It's very difficult to make a case against someone that just wants to embrace religion and live according to the Bible and live according to the religious principles of the time. So from that point of view, literacy is very important. Religion is very important. I would say they're the most important factors for a slave in terms of cracking open the nuts of their slavery. Let's talk about the early life of Olaudé. What are we going to talk about? We're going to talk about the context of the time, the social, political, ideological ideas of the time, and how this slave narrative emerges as a distinctly American genre. We already have captivity narratives as a purely American genre. Unfortunately, another one that has to do with tremendous violence, but also with adventure, is a slave narrative. Just think that at the same time, or not exactly at the same time, but in a very similar time, that stories like Treasure Island or Moll Flanders or Jane Eyre were being thought and written. I'm not saying that it's in the same period, because I know that many of them are not. They're separated by several decades or more. The same time as the rest of the world is fictionalizing exotic adventures or even domestic adventures, but full of changes and full of excitement, the American misery is so tremendous for a certain group of people, they only have to talk about their lives. And they create a narrative that is as powerful, as full of adventure, and as full of excitement as a story that was invented top to bottom by writers in England. So there still is not a space for American literature at this point to create something that is purely fictional. Probably because reality is just too brutal, and it's just too harsh, and they don't even need to fictionalize, they just have to talk about their own lives. Because everything that we've seen up to the moment, except for Benjamin Franklin's work, is experiential. Everything is about experience of the people. There's nothing that goes beyond the experience of the people. Puritanism, of course, but also we have Olaudé Equiano, we have Captain John Smith, they're all talking about their experiences, and those experiences are very tied to adventure and to an exotic setting if you read it from a European point of view. So they're going to be highly entertaining and highly successful. They're also going to work from a political point of view as a way of enhancing abolitionism and being the precursor, being the trailblazers, being the pioneers of what is today called African-American literature. African-American movements. Everything that we see today happening in the United States comes from these first stems of of rebelness, of disconformity with the status quo, of fighting against the system, of trying to defeat the system, putting your life on the line, and that's what we see, a very genuine account of a brave man's story. But I would also like you to pay attention to that small picture in the corner. Maybe you can't see it very well in the classroom, but you have a picture of this in your book, the frontispiece. He doesn't look like a coward, a cowardly slave. He looks like a brave, free man. He looks proud. And so sometimes the idea of self-representation in a picture to go along with the book is as important as the text itself. So this idea of inspiring other slaves through a picture of a very elegantly dressed, proud, freed black man is a very strong way of provoking that sentiment of freedom in other enslaved people. We're going to see this a lot in slavery. We're going to see this a lot in many authors. We're going to see that sometimes the strategy is very explicit. We see it in front of us. They're telling us exactly what we have to understand reading the stories. But other times, we're not going to see the message at first. There's going to be an implicit storyline. There's going to be implicit information that is not worded, but is as clear as the explicit information, because it's there. It's there for us to read in between the lines. We're going to see it today. We're going to see it even more next week in the case of Phyllis Wheatley and her poetry. We've already talked about the frontispiece, and we're going to try to connect the writer to other writers that some of them are in this in the notes that I wrote before the class, and I didn't see this slide, and I haven't read the slide for a year, so it just goes to show that once you connect these ideas, they stay there forever. In the case of William Bradford and Olaude Equiano, we could talk about the immigration experience, because both of them have that firsthand experience, and they talk about their way of arriving to a new world. In the case of William Bradford, full of hope for him and for his people. In the case of Olaude Equiano, after having lost everything and not knowing that everything that was even worse than what he had lived so far was yet to come, and how he overcomes all that difficulty. In the case of Mary Rowlandson and Olaude, we have two stories, two accounts of captivity. In the case of Benjamin Franklin and Olaude Equiano, we have two cases of self-made man. Everything that I have, I've earned with the sweat of my forehead. Okay? So fighting against the system implies breaking down all of the reasons that the white slave defenders had against the black people. They were ungodly creatures. Embrace religion. They're inferior intellectually. Learn to read and to write. Learn to tell your story. Learn to make your story meaningful. They are bad parents. They are bad husbands. Marry a white woman. For many of these slaves, an objective was to become a free man. And sometimes they would marry another black person. But it was very frequent to see intermarriage as a way of also making a point, making a declaration. Okay, so we're going to see that in this case, this happened. I'm not talking out of mere chance. The elements of his biography are extensive. I'm going to go over them very quickly. He was born in what is now Nigeria, in what is the predominant culture in Nigeria, the Igbo the Igbo culture, the Igbo tribes, which extend beyond Nigeria. But he was born in what is now Nigeria around 1745. It's impossible to know because he was just kidnapped and he was abducted at approximately the age of 11, along with his sister. And very soon, he was separated from his sister, and he never saw his sister again. That is the level of cruelty that slavery imposed on the enslaved. They did not have the right to their family. They did not have the right to live in peace. They did not have the right to stay where they belonged to. They only had the right to work and work and work until the day they died. At the minimum cost, if possible. Not eating very much. He was held captive in Africa for 7 months, traveling west under several masters. So as you can see, slavery wasn't just an operation where some white slavers would arrive with a boat, collect a group of people, and take them to America. It was something that that evil seed of slavery was, of course, connected to the money related to slavery. And there were Africans involved and white people involved. It was an operation that was as cruel from the perspective of a Western dominant class, but also from people of the own black race kidnapping young people in order to take them to a faraway, remote destiny where they didn't know what to expect. So you can only imagine that that was probably something that happened between rival tribes, between families that seek revenge. It would be like a way of getting back whatever had aggravated you in the first case. He was sold in 1756 to British traders and shipped to Barbados first, and then to West Indies. He finally was sent to Virginia. He was purchased and set to work in a plantation. Although he is not a plantation slave, he's not traditionally a plantation slave, he's more of a ship slave. And because very soon, only 1 month later, he was sold to Michael Henry Pascal, a British naval officer, for service aboard a ship. He traveled to England, where he was baptized into the Anglican Church in 1759. So as you can see, embracing religion is something very important to him. In the first 15 years of captivity, he manages to be baptized. His sea life offered him more opportunities for education than life in a plantation, which was absolutely brutal. Pascal made a promise to let him purchase his freedom, but afterwards did not follow through and did not allow him his freedom after the seven-year war that we've talked about before. He was sold to Captain James Doran, then to Robert King, a Quaker from Philadelphia. So we can see that, Philadelphia is in the northern states. Even though plantation states was where slavery was widespread, everybody knew that slaves were everywhere. Slaves were in Pennsylvania, slaves were in Vermont, slaves were in Massachusetts. The heavy slavery, the hard duty for the slaves was in the South, of course, because they were doing all the hard work to produce all the cotton, all the tobacco, all the tea that was afterwards sold. Tea after the revolution. King was a kind master and lent him to a benevolent captain called Thomas Farmer. King allowed Equiano to purchase his freedom in 1766. Laude Equiano left America for good in 1767. So as you can see, his story is very quick to develop. Because he felt racism despite being a freed man. Okay, so in the South there was tremendous racism. In the North there was standard racism. That was the difference between the North and the South around the mid-18th century. Afterwards, as the situation would become more polarized, the early American governments of the Republicans and the Federalists were more anti-slavery, more urbanites, and the southern states were more pro-slavery, pro-democrat, which if you think about it is exactly probably the opposite spectrum that we have nowadays with the Democrat Party that is a pro-civil rights and a Republican Party that is not following through in defending civil rights as much as they should. He lived in London for the rest of his life, working as a free servant, a barber, and a musician. Though he continued to travel and seek adventure, he went to different countries. He visited Turkey, Italy, the Arctic, Honduras, and Nicaragua. In the final years of his life, he married a white woman, Susan Cullen, after being a renowned advocate of interracial marriage. Okay? Probably as a way of seeking normality. What are the ideological contradictions of slavery? The ideological contradictions of slavery have to do with the type of world that was emerging in the 18th century. In the 18th century, racial laws were considered morally acceptable. Laws that were that would segregate the interactions of the whites and the blacks and stripping the black people from basically all of their rights. The enslavement of blacks after America became a nation was accepted in the name of prosperity and as a way of avoiding an early civil war once the republic had been formed. So even though some of the founding fathers had the idea of including the abolition as one of the parts of the American Constitution, nobody went so far as to try to enforce it, and all of them accepted slavery as a necessary evil. The ideological contradictions created an incredible divide between the North of America and the South of America, and that only got bigger and bigger and bigger. The ideological divide became highly politicized. That would lead only one century later to an American Civil War. Because the North no longer found any way of justifying the ideas of white supremacy and forced enslavement of millions of people that was defended by the Southern states. Dehumanizing blacks, and this, I talked about this at the beginning, made it easier to strip slaves of their human rights in the age of reason. Despite being in the age of reason, nothing about this is reasonable. Among the rights that were denied were literacy, although some 6,000 blacks produced slave memoirs of different length and literary quality. The other one I've said is religion. Let's quickly talk about slave narratives. Slave narratives became a successful new genre during the 18th century and extended for a very long period of time. We've already already said that the other slave narrative that we're going to read in this course is Frederick Douglass's slave narrative, and it takes place one century after Allaudet's experience. The genre has had a tremendous influence on American novel, and it is one of the pillars or the cornerstones of modern African-American literature. It was the main tenet, the main asset that anti-slavery propaganda had, the abolitionist movement had. And as in the case of explorer narratives or captivity narratives abroad, their popularity was also due to the nature of the stories that were filled with adventure, very quick tempo, and a lot of things happening, a real page-turner. Allaudet Equiano is considered the father of African-American literature, and Chinua Achebe, one of the most important literary scholars of post-colonialism, elevates his status to father of African literature. Equiano's autobiography is one of the most widely read and well-regarded in the genre. In recent years, it's become essential to read Equiano's work to be able to understand American literary tradition. It's not just another work. It's a work that must be read by everyone interested in American literature. Okay, so what are we going to read? We're going to read... by the way, I want just to make a small mention. Something that I find amazing about this book that I normally read from Puritanism to Postmodernism, is the very little attention, if not any, that it pays to slave narratives and slavery. And I guess it has to do also with the time when it was written. It's a mid-50s, if I'm not wrong. I think it's a mid-50s book. It just goes to show that what we consider right and wrong, what we consider re-evaluable in time, changes. You've already studied that in Comentario de Textos Literarios, how the second part of the 20th century is extremely revisionist with the reality of the world, and how writers that were never included in a literary canon, like slaves, like women, suddenly get a deserved spot in the American canon because of their literary quality, but also because of their historical relevance. So one of your jobs as future scholars is going to develop that critical capacity to be able to question whether everything that you're expected to read, it still holds in the lights of modern times, or if there are works that are missing there that we've just overlooked and we haven't been able to appreciate in their full dimension. Fortunately, in the 20th century, many of these wrongs were reversed and corrected, thanks to scholars like Chinua Achebe. The works of Olaude Equiano originally are called The Interesting Narrative of the Life of Olaude Equiano, or Gustavus Vasa, the African, written by himself. So there's a statement there in that title. It's not only a tremendously long, unnecessarily long title, it's also a title of, this is my old name and this is my new name. This is a name that I brought from my land. This is a name that I take because I'm empowered to take it. It's a tale of empowerment. He writes the African with a capital A as a way of saying that he's proud of coming where he comes from. He embraces the religion that is dominant in America or in England, but he identifies himself as an African. He tries to offer an honest recollection of his childhood in Africa based on an idealized reconstruction of his long-lost experience. He does something that nowadays would be considered plagiarism, but that was very common at the time. He feels free to borrow extensively from other texts, mostly historical sources, and abolitionist literature of the time. Nowadays, that would be a scandal. At the time, it was perfectly normal. It garnished Washington Irving with a tremendously long and successful career, for example, and most of his works were retelling of works that already existed. But we'll get there in a few weeks. He uses the trope of the talking book common in works of other black writers. And I have the doubt whether that trope of the talking book is in the glossary. I think it is. And maybe we can read it. It's not in the glossary itself. But at the end of the day, what you have to come away with is the idea that there is an almost sacred connection, or there is an inference that being able to be literate will open so many doors that you have the feeling that books talk to you. Books give you inspiration for life. Books drive your life. So that trope of the talking book, that personification of a book, is highly common at the time with Black writers, and it was a way of enhancing the experience of becoming literate. Conversion to Christianity has two ways of being interpreted. It's an assimilation of the enslaver's culture, but at the same time, it creates a distinct and unrefutable sense of equalness between the person that has been enslaved and the person that was the enslaver. So by bringing them to the same point, it puts a relationship in terms of one Christian one supposed Christian is abusing another Christian. And that's so sinful. It incurs in many capital sins. Okay, so the way of conquesting respect by the rest of society is embracing society, not trying to change it or trying to impose a different experience, but to embrace the main tenets of the society they are. Trying to become free members of. Embracing Christianity is fundamental. It's fundamental. If slaves had decided to not be Christian, it would have been a much steeper path towards abolition because they could have continued to be called ungodly as a way of justifying the crimes committed against them. His narrative has a three-part structure, each one with a distinctive form, style, and tone. So it's like in three acts, very classical. It reached an international audience and made the horrifying facts of slavery become known worldwide, though he tried to tone down the gory aspects of his experience. He tried to make it acceptable for all readers and avoided going too much into detail in the most gruesome parts. He fought as an abolitionist activist, denouncing cases like the Merchant Zong that had thrown 132 ill slaves overboard in order to claim insurance severance as a policy covered drowned slaves, not ill slaves. So those types of practices happen, and they continue to happen for decades. He was encouraged to write by literate ex-slaves in order to counter the notion that blacks were intellectually inferior. We've already heard this idea now. We're going to hear it massively next week. He was already well known in England when his two-volume autobiography was published. In recent years, Equiano has become essential to study American literary tradition. So without further ado, let's hit the work itself. Let me ask you, what is a trope? A trope is a literary figure, something that is recurrent. For example, a metaphor is a trope. I don't know who asked this question. It was like 3 minutes ago, I think. José Antonio Pérez, right? José Antonio, that's what a trope means. A trope is a literary figure that we use for a certain purpose. For example, personification can be one of them. In these presentations, I always leave two things that you should probably pay attention to as much time as you have. Links to documentaries and the source of his works, so you can read them in full manner if you want. In this case, even as an audiobook, his biography in the prestigious biographyonline.net website, the Wikipedia entry of his book, which is well written and very interesting. The full text of his book is available on Gutenberg.org. There is a very interesting PBS documentary available, and on the ProQuest Literature Online resources that you have through the Biblioteca Central, which is a fantastic resource for literary students. You have access not only to his biography, but to all the biographies in the book. There's a link there in case you want to click on it and have a look. As you can see, he's not just another figure. He's very relevant. In all of these presentations, I always include some interesting links, and there's a link to the ones that are suggested in class. It's resources and link. The last link is something that I always insist on when I talk to you individually. I haven't done it very much this year in a group dynamic. If you want to test how much you know about an author, there's nothing as effective as taking the quiz that Professor Giret publishes at the end of each unit. She pays a lot of attention to it. So if you take it repeatedly until you perfect yourself, she probably knows. She probably knows that you're doing that. She spends a lot of time reviewing those results. So I highly recommend you to continue working on those if you already have. And if you haven't, it's a great opportunity to discover them. They're in the section called quizzes or cuestionario, depending on whether your browser is in English or in Spanish. We talked about the frontispiece. Let me quickly go to page 114. And it says, we are going to read some excerpts from the second chapter in which Equiano, in his mid-40s, records events that had happened more than 30 years earlier. He begins by casting himself retrospectively in the role of a noble primitive child who was leading an idyllic life with his family. Then he explains how he was kidnapped and sold to several masters in Africa. Later on, he recounts a horror he experienced during the infamous Middle Passage across the Atlantic Ocean from Africa to America. He also offers a first-hand description of how the slaves were sold in the West Indies. The last excerpt in our selection includes a passionate, overt appeal addressed by the author to his Christian audience in order to consider the lack of accord between their professed ideals and their actual practice concerning their immoral treatment of slaves. So I'm going to try to read through all of it. I have like 20 minutes, a bit less. If I was not successful, I'll go to the very end and I'll read from the last page, from page 119, if I weren't to reach that. But I'll let you know. If we hear the bell ring, I'll have to go forward a few pages. My father, besides many slaves, had a numerous family, of which seven lived to grow up, including myself and a sister, who was the only daughter. As I was the youngest of the sons, I became, of course, the greatest favorite with my mother and was always with her. And she used to take particular pains to form my mind. I was trained up from my earliest years in the art of war. My daily exercise was shooting and throwing javelins. And my mother adorned me with emblems after the manner of our greatest warriors. In this way, I grew up until I had turned the age of 11, when an end was put to my happiness in the following manner. Generally, when the grown people in the neighborhood were gone far in the fields to labor, the children assembled together in some of the neighboring premises to play. And commonly, some of us used to get up a tree to look out for any assailant or kidnapper that might come upon us, for they sometimes took these opportunities of our parents' absence to attack and carry off as many as they could seize. One day, when all the people were gone, out to their works as usual, and I and my dear sister were left to mind the house, two men and a woman got over our walls, and in a moment seized us both, and without giving us time to cry out or make resistance, they stopped our mouth and ran off with us into the nearest wood. Here they tied our hands and continued to carry us as far as they could till night came on, when we reached the small house where the robbers halted for refreshment and spent the night. We were then unbound, but were unable to take any food, and being quite overpowered by fatigue and grief, our only relief was some sleep, which allayed our misfortune for a short time. The next morning we left the house and continued traveling all the day. At length, after many days traveling, during which I had often changed masters, I got into the hands of a chieftain in a very pleasant country. This man had two wives and some children, and they all used me extremely well and did all they could do to comfort me, particularly the first wife, who was something like my mother. Although I was a great many days' journey from my father's house, yet these people spoke exactly the same language with us. This first master of mine, as I may call him, was a smith, and my principal employment was working his bellows, which were the same kind as I had seen in my vicinity. I want to call your attention over the fact of how quickly he goes over his kidnapping and being taken away. It's part of the strategy of the story to go fast in certain parts and to gloss slowly over other parts, because that way he highlights the parts that he thinks are more interesting for his agenda, and he goes over quickly some concepts that could also highlight the facts that brutality wasn't a black and white thing. It was an evil or non-evil person thing, and that some of the evil people involved in the story were from not only from his same race, but from the same tribe, probably from rival families, or who knows, or just greedy people that wanted money. The first object which saluted my eyes when I arrived on the coast was a sea and a slave ship, which was then riding at anchor and waiting for its cargo. These filled me with astonishment, which was soon converted into terror. When I was carried on board, I was immediately handled and tossed up to see if I were sound by some of the crew, and was now persuaded that I had gotten into a world of bad spirits, and they were going to kill me. Their complexions, too, differing so much from ours, their long hair, and the language they spoke, which was very different from any I had ever heard, united to confirm me in this belief. Indeed, such were the horrors of my views and fears at the moment, that if 10,000 worlds had been my own, I would have freely parted with them all to have exchanged my condition with that of the meanest slave in my own country. When I looked round the ship too, and saw a large furnace of copper boiling, and a multitude of black people of every description chained together, every one of their countenances expressing dejection and sorrow, I no longer doubted of my fate, and quite overpowered with horror and anguish, I felt motionless on the deck and fainted. When I recovered a little, I found some black people about me, who I believed were some of those who had brought me on board, and had been receiving their pay. They talked to me in order to cheer me, but it was all in vain. I asked them if we were not to be eaten by those white men with horrible looks, red faces, and long hair. They told me I was not, and one of the crew brought me a small portion of spirituous liquor in a wine glass. But being afraid of him, I would not take it out of his hand. One of the blacks, therefore, took it from him and gave it to me, and I took a little down my palate, which instead of reviving me as they thought it would, threw me into the greatest consternation at the strange feeling it produced, having never tasted any such liquor before. Soon after this, the blacks who brought me on board went off and left me abandoned to despair. I now saw myself deprived of all chance of returning to my native country, or even the last glimpse of hope of gaining the shore, which I now considered as friendly. And I even wished for my former slavery in preference to my present situation, which was filled with horrors of every kind, still heightened by my ignorance of what I was to undergo. I was not long suffered to indulge my grief. I was soon put down under the decks. And then I received such a salutation in my nostrils I had never experienced in my life. Have a look at the difference between this story, this part of the story, and the previous part of the story. How he glosses very quickly over the kidnapping, and then he goes into detail talking about the moments previous to sailing off to America, the tremendously foul air, the bad experience. So he's being more detailed when he thinks it's convenient, and he's being less detailed when he thinks it's not convenient to be more detailed. I received such a salutation in my nostrils as I had never experienced in my life, so that with the loathsomeness of the stench and crying together, I became so sick and low that I was not able to eat, nor had I the least desire to taste anything. I now wished for the last friend, death, to relieve me, but soon, to my grief, two of the white men offered me eatables, and on my refusing to eat them, one of them held me fast by the hands and laid me across, I think, the windlass, and tied my feet, while the other flogged me severely. I had never experienced anything of this kind before, and although not being used to the water, I naturally feared the element the first time I saw it. Nevertheless, could I have got over the nettings, I would have jumped over the side, but I could not. And besides, a crew used to watch very closely, who were not changed, who was not changed down to the decks, lest we should leap into the water. And I have seen some of these poor African prisoners most severely cut for attempting to do so, and hourly whipped for not eating. This indeed was often the case with myself. In a little time after, amongst the poor chain men, I found some of my own nation, which in a small degree gave ease of mind. I inquired of these what was to be done with us. They gave me to understand we were to be carried to these white people's country to work for them. I then was a little revived and thought, if it were no worse than working, my situation was not so desperate. But still I feared I should be put to death. The white people looked and acted, as I thought, in so brute, savage a manner, for I had never seen among any blacks such instance of brutal cruelty, and this not only shown towards us blacks, but also to some of the whites themselves. What is he doing in this part? He's subverting the roles. Black people get the label of unhuman savages. He demonstrates how the real savages are the white people, the white slave traders. So he's being extremely subversive and explicitly subversive, contrary to other parts where he's implicitly subversive, or if you've read Phyllis Wheatley's verses that are in the Peck, you can see some hints of subversive, of hidden subversiveness, of implicit subversiveness. One white man in particular I saw when we were permitted to be on deck, flogged so unmercifully with a large rope near the foremast that he died as a consequence of it, and they tossed him over the side as they would have done a brute. This made me fear these people the more, and I expected less than to be treated in the same manner. I could not help expressing my fears and apprehensions to some of my countrymen. I asked them if these people had no country, but lived in this hollow place, the ship. They told me they did not, but came from a distant one. Then said I, how comes it in all our country we never heard of them? They told me because they lived so very far off. I then asked where were their women, had they any like themselves? I was told they had. And why, said I, do we not see them? They answered, because they were left behind. I asked how the vessel could go. They told me the ropes could tell, but that there was a cloth put upon the mat by the help of the ropes. I saw. And then the vessel went on, and the white men had some spell or magic they put in the water when they liked in order to stop the vessel. So he's absolutely unfamiliar with navigation, with sea navigation. So whenever he sees an anchor or anything, that he thinks that the boat moves through magic. And that whenever they stop the boat, it's through magic, throwing a chain into the water and singing an incantation. Actually, it was the anchor what they were throwing into the water. I was exceedingly amazed at this account and really thought they were spirits. I therefore wished much to be from against them, for I expected they would sacrifice me, but my wishes were vain, for we were so quartered that it was impossible for any of us to make our escape. At last, when the ship we were in had got in all her cargo, they made ready with many fearful noises, and we were all put under deck, so that we could not see how they met as a vessel. But this disappointment was the least of my sorrow. The stench of the hold, while we were on the coast, was so intolerably loathsome that it was dangerous to remain there for any time. And some of us had been permitted to stay on deck for the fresh air. But now that the whole ship's cargo were confined together, it became absolutely pestilent. The closeness of the ship and the heat of the climate added to the number in the ship, which was so crowded that each had scarcely room to turn himself, soon became unfit for respiration. From a variety of loathsome smells and brought on a sickness among the slave, of which many dies, thus falling victims to the improvident avarice, as I may call it, of their purchases. I want you to pay attention to the length of the sentence. The sentence starts on line 115 and extends all the way to line 121. As I said, we probably wouldn't have time to read through the whole text. I'm going to skip page 118 and I'm going to read the small part on page 119. We were not many days in the merchant's custody before we were sold after their usual manner, which was this: on a signal given as a beat of the drum, the buyers rush at once into the yard where the slaves are confined and make choices of that parcel they like best. The noise and clamor with which this is attended and the eagerness visible in the countenance of the buyer serve not a little to increase the apprehension of terrified Africans, who may well be supposed to consider them as the ministers of that destruction to which they think themselves devoted. In this manner, without scruple, our relations and friends separated, most of them never to see other again. I remember in the vessel in which I was brought over, in the men's apartment, there were several brothers who in the sale were sold in different lots. And it was very moving on that occasion to see and hear their cries at parting. Oh, ye nominal Christians, might not an African ask you, learned you this from your God, who says unto you, do unto all men as you would men should do unto you? So he's using the Bible in a subversive way against the white man. Is it not enough that we are torn from our country and friends to toil for your luxury and lust of gain? Luxury and lust, capital sins. Lust especially. Must every tender feeling be likewise sacrificed to your avarice? Capital sin. Are the dearest friends and relations now rendered more dear by their separation from their kindred, still to be parted from each other and thus prevented from cheering the gloom of slavery with the small comfort of being together and mingling their sufferings and sorrows? Why are parents to lose their children, brothers or sisters, or husbands their wives? Surely this is a new refinement in cruelty which will, while it has no advantage to atone for it, thus aggravates distress and adds fresh horrors even to the wretchedness, the evilness, the deplorably bad of slavery. Okay? So I think that you have a general idea Thank you very much for those of you that resisted until the very end. And thank you to those who came to class, as usual. Have a great week. We'll talk about Phyllis Wheatley next week. Okay? Goodbye.